Literature and the Common Reader, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a conversation with a leading international literary critic, Dennis Donahue of New York University and University College Dublin. Later on the show this week, a conversation about D.H. Lawrence, the British writer who helped to shape modern attitudes toward literature and sexuality. I'll talk with Lawrence's biographer, David Ellis of the University of Kent at Canterbury. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated.
Well, now, at some stage, about perhaps 15 years ago for many people, there arose a kind of scruple that philosophers started telling the common reader, look here, you're really being very naive. Mm-hmm. You don't know what you're doing. And you'd better try and think it out as to what exactly you're up to.
Critic Dennis Donahue, who says that literary scholarship nowadays is not so much confused as unsatisfactory. According to Dennis Donahue, this situation reflects a shift of interest from the practice of reading to the theory of reading, a shift in which the emphasis is nearly always political rather than aesthetic. Dennis Donahue is the author of studies of Emily Dickinson, Jonathan Swift, and William Butler Yeats. Among his recent publications is Warren Point, a memoir of his boyhood in the north of Ireland. During a recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, he worked on a study of the 19th century British writer Walter Pater. I asked Dennis Donahue to reflect on modern literature and popular readership.
Well, the common reader, insofar as there is such, and insofar as he or she simply buys a book, becomes interested in it for one reason or another, such a person doesn't need to involve himself or herself in any theoretical insistences at all. I mean, theory is really, to some extent, you could almost regard it as a kind of secular translation of what had been a religious, divine or theological scruple, and indeed many activities of the university world, certainly in the last 200 years, have been best understood as translations downward or as secularizations of what were fundamentally theological niceties. And of course, as we know, for centuries, if you really wanted nicety and scruple and differentiation and so on, you went to the theologians.
Right.
Who could indeed dance on those pins we heard so much about. But the people who are now, there's a kind of theological or post-theological scruple at work in literary theory. And I don't regard it, I must say, as a bad thing, though it's very often a tiresome thing, but I don't necessarily regard it as a bad thing. What I do feel is a bad thing is the politicization of literature, and even more so the politicization of reading. Because that seems to me to be damaging. That is the implication, and of course it's more than an implication, it's on the part of many critics an insistence that the definition of reality is a political definition, and therefore literature must be read as a political activity.
Can you give me a very specific example?
Well, it goes back, I must say, to be fair, it goes back relatively quite a long way. Sometime in the 1930s, Thomas Mann said, in our time, the destiny of man presents its meanings in political terms. Mm. Now, in effect, that might well be the motto for a great deal of what is going on today by way of literary theory and the practice of reading. That is the implication that there was a time in which the destiny of man presented its meanings in religious terms, or in theological terms, or in moral terms, or whatever. But now, the implication is that it presents its meanings in political terms.
Now, let me bring you back to a word again, Dennis Donahue, that you used in a recent presentation here at the Humanities Center. You described yourself, now help me with the proper wording, as an adherent of the word aesthetic when you come to the doing of literature. And in turn, you spoke about your interest in a 19th century writer, a man named Walter Pater. Tell me how those all come together.
Well, I am very much committed to, though that seems the wrong verb to use in this setting, I'm very much committed to the notion of an aesthetic reading of literature, or indeed an aesthetic viewing of a work of art, or an aesthetic listening to a piece of music.
Does that mean non-theoretical?
No, not at all. What it means is that when we read a work of literature, there's a very useful remark that T.S. Eliot made many years ago, when he said, when you read literature, it is as literature you must read it, and not as another thing. Now, nobody, of course, today, except myself, would believe that, or would believe that Eliot is right. But what I'm trying to do is, in effect, to say that Eliot is right. That is, that when we read a work of literature, it is as a work of literature we must read it.
Does that make you very sophisticated or very naive?
It depends on whom you're speaking to. In one way, I'm very naive. In another way, I'm far more sophisticated than the sophisticates. What I'm trying to say is, a poem is not an editorial in the local newspaper. A poem is not an argument in a pub. A poem is not a conversation. A poem is a structure. It is a form of words, a highly elaborate, complex structure, which must not be reduced to the kind of thing you would talk about in a pub.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the real difficulty today is to gain attention for that kind of emphasis. It's to gain attention for a kind of emphasis which is not reductive, which is not political, which is not theological. That is, which says a work of art is to be approached on the understanding, however complicated that understanding must be, that it is indeed a work of art.
But you tell me that it's not political. It's social, but not necessarily political.
What I'm opposed to is, as it were, the automatic ideological reduction of a work of art to what appear to be its political bearings. Now, I'm opposed to that because I think it refutes and it subverts the fundamental character of the imagination. Because to me, the reason why the human imagination is in fact perhaps the unique faculty and the uniquely important faculty is the human imagination is that capacity by which we can imagine being different. There's a wonderful passage in Gerard Manley Hopkins's early journals where he refers to the time when he was a child, and I said to myself, what must it be to be different? Now, it seems to me that the imagination is that capacity. It is the capacity to imagine oneself being different.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that that is the basis of sympathy, that is the basis of a genuine politics, a genuine justice, a genuine ethics. Now, I would take the line that when, for example, we read a poem, the first act we performed is that of imagining what it would be like to say those words. Now, it would not be, in my view, it would be a very bad reading, which would simply say, well, how can I reduce those words to myself? How can I somehow nullify or remove the difference?
The object is to get out of yourself.
Yes, the object is to imagine what it would be like to say those words. That's why, for example, the political reduction seems to me to be peculiarly nefarious, because the political reduction is in effect saying to the writer, be like me.
Right.
Don't be different.
Adopt my way of thinking.
Adopt my way of thinking. If I am a bourgeois liberal, you be a bourgeois liberal. If I'm a capitalist, you be a capitalist. If I'm a Marxist, you be a Marxist.
Dennis Donahue, tell me about your interest in Pater. Here we have the word aesthetics in front of us.
Well, Walter Pater was an English don at Oxford. He taught, as all dons at the time did, he taught classics. He was a Latin and Greek scholar. He was also a scholar in the history of art and the history of mythology. But what he's most famous for is that in 1873 he wrote a book called Studies in the History of the Renaissance. And that attempted to represent what should be done by what he called the aesthetic critic. Now, by the aesthetic critic, he meant to differentiate himself from the kind of criticism that was then being written by a John Ruskin or by a Matthew Arnold, which Pater would have seen as being very much a public, social kind of criticism. Now, when he represented himself as the aesthetic critic, what he meant was a critic who is chiefly concerned with artistic forms, with types of artistic experience, with these experiences as forms or exemplifications of other possible experiences.
Are we talking about art for art's sake?
Yes, to a large extent, it is art for art's sake. And, uh-huh, of course, the very fact that one can use a phrase like that, which is now to a large extent diminished, it's very difficult. This is to rephrase something I said earlier. It's very difficult to gain for art, for a work of art, that kind of attention.
All right. Now, is this the camp, the critical camp in which you place yourself?
Oh, yes. I would see myself very much as an aesthete. And even, you see, that very word, I mean, if you represent yourself as an aesthete,
You think of somebody detached?
You think of someone, some rather wimpish, detached, utterly disengaged, solipsistic person, morally, probably decadent, corrupt, heartless.
Well, this
all
is
of
not,
these things.
This is not the Dennis Donahue I know.
This is, of course, what I see in the mirror first thing in the morning. But no, I seriously regard aesthetics as one distinctive mode of attention. Another mode of attention.
Not the only mode.
Not the only mode. Right. Not at all. Not
Fair
at
enough.
All. Because after all, you know, one of the weakest parts of the aesthetic position arises precisely from an attempt somehow to spread an aesthetic viewpoint over the whole of life. And that, of course, has been done. There are various philosophers have attempted from time to time to deduce an ethic from an aesthetic.
That is to say, a way of behaving.
Yes, but to ask of a way of behavior that it be beautiful and uh-huh. that it fulfill the criteria of beauty rather than that it fulfill necessarily the criteria of, say, justice.
Does this represent for you, Dennis Donahue, something that you actually passionately, truly believe in yourself, or is it a way simply to negotiate the sort of perilous journey of the critic?
No, I believe in this myself. That is, I really believe that I must try to persuade my students, for example, that when they sit down to read a poem, that they must give it a particular kind of attention. Mm-hmm. Not the kind of attention, or not necessarily the same kind of attention that they give to, you know, ordinary conversation and so on. You see, poetry is difficult. Literature is difficult. Form is difficult.
Life is earnest. Life is real.
Yeah, yeah, but form is difficult. It's very difficult, for example, in reading a poem, to try to divine what is the principle of energy, let's call it that, by which the poem gets from its first word to its last. Uh-huh. But that's quite a different matter than asking, was W.B. Yeats a fascist? Was T.S. Eliot anti-Semitic? That's quite a different... These are different, quite different questions. And the questions about Eliot's anti-Semitism or Yeats's fascism, these are, I'm afraid, increasingly perhaps, the kind of questions that one is asking and answering today. I don't want to answer, or I don't want merely to answer those questions. I want to take a poem like Eliot's Merida or his Gerontion or The Wasteland and ask what in fact is going on which enables this poem to get from its first word to its last. That's a very difficult issue.
Dennis Donahue, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are the Henry James Professor of Literature at New York University. You're here at the Humanities Center working on a project about Walter Pater. Thank you for participating on Soundings. Good luck in your work.
Thank you.
You're listening to Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond.
As a biographer, I remain fascinated by Lawrence because I think, above all, he was an extraordinarily adventurous and courageous person who was always trying things out, who was always trying to go forward, who had a hatred and a positive dread of getting stuck, of stasis. And I admire in him that courage, and which includes, of course, the courage to make an absolute fool of yourself, which he was conscious of doing from time to time, and I think he did positively do from time to time.
Literary biographer David Ellis, one of three contributors to a new biography of the British writer D.H. Lawrence, published by Cambridge University Press. David Ellis's book will deal with Lawrence's life and work from the time he left Europe in 1922 until his death from tuberculosis in 1930. including, therefore, the 3 years that he spent in the United States. Because he was the author of Lady Chatterley's Lover, many readers associate Lawrence with literary scandal. Others view him as a forerunner of modern sexual liberation. According to David Ellis, D.H. Lawrence was indeed concerned with sexual matters, but with a complexity that only recently has become the object of critical study. David Ellis teaches at the University of Kent at Canterbury. In addition to his work on D.H. Lawrence, he's the author of a book about William Wordsworth and Sigmund Freud. I asked David Ellis to comment on D.H. Lawrence as an interpreter of modern sexuality. Should we remember him, for instance, primarily as the author of Lady Chatterley's Lover?
No, his concern with sex is not an exception. I mean, he was, throughout his life, concerned with sexual matters. What's different from the stereotype is that his concern was extremely complicated, and that F.R. Leavis's presentation of him, for example, as a celebrator of heterosexual normality, begins to seem very paradoxical, I think, in the light of the accumulating evidence.
How do you figure out, David Ellis, the relationship between the man's life and the man's artistry, whether you're talking about sexuality or the erotic or the larger difference between the life and the work? As a biographer, what kind of a challenge is that to you?
Well, it's an enormous challenge, because it was one of the ways that, playing on that difference, was one of the ways in which he was insulted and demeaned in his own time, and has been since, I think. People read these books, which are very concerned with sexual matters and contain, Lady Chatterley, for example, a great deal of sexual activity.
Uh-huh.
And they claimed well, there was a kind of discrepancy between the imaginative life and the real life. I began by being very interested in autobiography, mm-hmm. and the way people conceive their own lives, and the way in which, in a sense, they create themselves in retrospection, by looking back over their own lives. And that's one literary activity, and it's one, actually, that Lawrence didn't practice in any systematic way.
So he did not write an autobiography as such.
He wrote a number of autobiographical short pieces, but uh-huh. he did not write a full-scale autobiography. On the other hand, his fiction, of course, is, in another sense, tremendously autobiographical. But then the other activity of telling life stories is the biographical one. And that, I think, is a very different one, but involves some problems which are similar. The problem about... Well, when we talk about a life story, or talking about writing a biography, rather, we think of the life as lying about, that you dig it up somewhere, that it pre-exists,
right.
That it has to be on Earth.
Uh-huh.
Well, of course, to a large extent, that's not true, and to a large extent, lives are created. But they're created more obviously and in a more obvious fashion in autobiography than, I think, in biography. But nevertheless, even in biography, there's a great deal of creating, shaping, selecting, choosing what to put in, what to mm-hmm. put out, what to leave out.
David, what's the biggest challenge that you face in assembling the facts and the interpretive possibilities about the latter part of Lawrence's life?
Well, there are sort of technical challenges to do with the mass of material that you have at the end of Lawrence's life, because you get the impression that everybody who met Lawrence went home immediately and wrote about him. It was enormous. and he himself, of course, wrote lots of letters and continually, in a sense, dealt with his own experience in fiction or in journalism. The biggest challenge is a challenge I suppose any biographer feels. Lawrence is an extraordinarily complicated person, and there is a challenge of balance, there's a challenge of tone. You want to avoid hero worship, mm-hmm. I've had enough of that. You want to avoid mindless denigration. You want to weigh up the evidence and produce some kind of balanced judgment. And at the same time, if you're interested in literature, you want to do all this whilst remembering this is a great writer.
It sounds to me like you're going to be very unpredictable. You're going to keep the reader on his or her toes so that there's not a particular line that you're going to follow here.
David, how is D.H. Lawrence holding up in the current atmosphere of literary criticism with all of the ideological conflicts that...
Well, I'm not sure he's holding up. I think he's fallen down in some ways. there's a bizarre situation in England anyway where he's still much read, and students, and female students, like his work, enthusiastic about his work. Mm-hmm. You can get recruitment for courses on Lawrence. Is healthy, but in a way, his relationship to critical theory, it's not particularly that people interested in the theorists, if you like, have mm-hmm. have attacked him especially. Of course, there's a feminist attack on Lawrence, but apart from that, I don't think there's been any special animus or dislike. But I think people have tended to shy away from him because he doesn't invite the kind of interest that Joyce does.
What is the basis, for example, of the feminist attack on Lawrence's view of what, heterosexuality?
Yes, if you like, but I mean the basis from Simone de Beauvoir through Kate Millett to now to much more sophisticated versions, I think, is simply that Lawrence
used women,
if you like. But what he did was have an idea of the ideal married relationship, uh-huh. in which the man was to be acknowledged in certain ways as dominant, and to be followed, and to be obeyed in certain ways. There is a part of Lawrence. It's only a part of Lawrence's thinking about marriage, which is a kind of updating of a very Victorian ideal.
In the larger sense of our contemporary notions of sexuality and gender, how is Lawrence faring on that score?
Well, he's not faring. I don't know how he's faring. I don't know what his rating is in various parts of the world. But perhaps he's not faring too well. And I think there's a sense in which that's a bit surprising, because Lawrence was very interested, for example, in ideas of bisexuality, which he. He certainly felt that everybody was to a certain degree bisexual. I would have thought there's a kind of interest around the early part of his career when he was interested in disciples of Freud, which might attract certain kinds of modern inquiry. But I don't know. You'd have to ask them.
What is your sense, David Ellis, of why people read D.H. Lawrence in the 1990s? Why is he an important part of literary history?
Well, there are so many answers to that question. I mean, one of my answers is simply a rather naive one. Now, it will sound naive, and that is he is really a very good writer, and he can write in such a variety of ways and write very successfully. I don't think people read him any more as they read him in the 60s for that kind of for the championing of sexual liberation, but they read him for the reasons that people have always read novels.
A good story,
remarkable treatment of character, of setting. Mm-hmm. Extraordinarily acute psychological insight, and a gift for words, if you like.
Does Lawrence's criticism of American culture, does that continue to have some weight and some value for the social critics, indeed for yourself as a biographer?
Well, the relationship with America I find fascinating. I'm a bit surprised in some ways that studies in classical American literature has done so well here, because, and in a sense is one of the seminal, if I can use that dreadful word, books for American critics.
Oh, it's a classic for graduate students.
So I believe, because what's interesting, what's challenging, I suppose, about Lawrence's attitude to America is that he was only fascinated, is a better word, by the Indians, by the Native Americans, by the part of America which hadn't been colonized and wasn't wasn't industrial and so on.
Was he prescient in his criticism of American culture and his recognition of that part of our society?
Well, that again is a question Americans themselves must answer. He thought America was interesting because it represented the furthest stage, if you like, on the way to total collapse that of white civilization. He very much wanted to come to America because he felt he could see what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. That we were all heading for a great cataclysm, and America was leading the way in its in the development of its industrial and commercial culture.
David Ellis, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are one of three biographers of D.H. Lawrence, a senior lecturer at the University of Canterbury. Good luck in your work.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette copy of this week's show. You've been listening to Conversations featuring Dennis Donahue of New York University and University College Dublin, and David Ellis of the University of Kent at Canterbury. During recent fellowships at the National Humanities Center, Dennis Donahue and David Ellis worked on studies of the British writers Walter Pater and D.H. Lawrence. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 635. That's program number 635, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The center welcomes your comments and suggestions. Next week, a new interpretation of the American West. My guest will be Jane Tompkins, a professor of English at Duke University. We'll talk about her new book, West of Everything. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Literary Lives, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for a conversation about literature and the common reader. I'll talk with Dennis Donahue of New York University. You'll also hear a discussion about the British writer D.H. Lawrence. I'll talk with Lawrence's biographer, David Ellis, of the University of Kent at Canterbury. Literary Lives, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.